I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 19th of January. In December, the U.S. Supreme Court heard a second round of arguments in the Abigail Fisher versus the University of Texas. It's an important affirmative action case and could not only determine affirmative action at the University of Texas, but also the rest of the nation. Fisher was rejected by the University of Texas. She is white. She claims she was not accepted on basis of her race. The case was heard in the Supreme Court in 2012 and then sent back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, where they ruled that Fisher failed to make her case. She appealed to the Supreme Court again in 2015. We'll hear the details of this case and hear why our guest believes the Supreme Court's case on race and admissions matters more than ever. Our guest this hour is Liliana Garces. She's Assistant Professor of Education at Pennsylvania State University and a Research Associate in the Center for the Study of Higher Education. She taught at the Graduate School of Education and Human Development at George Washington University and completed a postdoc fellowship at the National Poverty Center in the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. She teaches courses on education policy and politics, higher education, law, race, law, and education, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for her. This is still a rather contentious issue, and I would imagine that we'll have quite a few phone calls this hour. To join us, our number is 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page where we'd like to read your messages is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter as well, and that's at K Dunn Show. Liliana, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. It should be an interesting hour. Why does the Supreme Court case on race and admissions matter more than ever?
Well, as you mentioned in your opening remarks, this is an important case where the court is looking at the constitutionality of race-conscious policies, particularly at the University of Texas at Austin. And this is a policy that UT Austin deems necessary to further its educational mission. And even though the case involves some facts that are very specific to UT Austin, it's a decision that could have broader implications for the ability of institutions of higher education to use race and admissions policies and in turn to be able to further their educational mission.
And tell me how UT uses race as part of an admissions process. What are their thoughts on that? What do they do?
Yes, well, UT has what's called a blended admission system, and that system has two components. The first, which is not being challenged in this case, is an automatic admissions policy through what's called the Top 10% Plan. This is the state law that the state passed in 1996 in response to a court decision at the time that had prohibited the consideration of race at institutions in Texas. And what the policy does is it guarantees every student in the top 10% of his or her high school class a admission to one of the flagship institutions at Texas. The percentage of students who are admitted under this automatic admissions process. And then those students who don't graduate at the top 10% of their class are then considered under a holistic review, which UT Austin uses, and that's where they look at race as a factor. Mm-hmm. And in this holistic review, students are evaluated on both their academic and their personal achievement. You have a personal achievement score that's based on a number of determinations. They look at leadership potential, extracurricular activities, any honors and awards, any work experience, and what they then call special circumstances. And these special circumstances has a number of attributes, including socioeconomic status, and that's where they then also look at race.
And why did the Supreme Court send this back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals?
Well, there is a lot of speculation as to what happened in that decision. It's been characterized as a compromise decision, where the court agreed to reach a particular outcome where they were then asking the Fifth Circuit to see whether the consideration of race in this holistic process was in fact necessary for UT Austin to be able to further its interest in diversity.
Mm-hmm.
What they were trying to do by looking at race as a factor, a factor of a factor. The court was not convinced that the Fifth Circuit had reached this determination on its own, that it was concerned that they had deferred in some ways to the institution on this consideration of whether looking at race in this holistic process was necessary. They asked the Fifth Circuit to look at that again. The Fifth Circuit did. They agreed once more with UT Austin, saying that, in fact, it was necessary because UT Austin had looked at these other alternatives, including the top 10% plan. They had tried to complement it with a lot of other efforts and outreach and recruitment in order to be able to have the students who qualify for admission under the plan to apply. To know about it, to be able to consider their application, and also to for them to be able to enroll so that they could address any financial considerations for these students.
Mm-hmm.
And because, so the Fifth Circuit essentially determined that UT Austin had explored these other alternatives and had not achieved the diversity that they felt was necessary to be able to satisfy their goal of having a racially diverse student body. Now, under court rules, you can appeal that again. Ms. Fisher did, and it only takes 4 votes at the Supreme Court for them to agree to hear a case. When we look at the composition of the court, you had the 4 votes in that case, and they agreed to hear it.
Mm-hmm. Fisher's attorney says that he thinks that the university needs to be clearer on its use of race as a factor in admissions. Do you think the university is pretty clear and the public understands this, or is it not? Could it be clearer?
I think that UT Austin has been clear in presenting its case in the way in which race is considered. As I mentioned, you know, it's this factor of a factor of a factor, and that's what they've alleged in, you know, presented a lot of the information for how it is that it's used.
Obviously, one of the issues at play here, and I wonder if the Supreme Court takes this into consideration, is whether or not there are racially and ethnically diverse student body populations in colleges and universities around the country. Is that under consideration by the Supreme Court, and is that something that most universities and colleges are striving to achieve?
Yes, that is what universities and colleges are striving to achieve with this policy. When I use the term race-conscious policy, I do it very intentionally, because we can talk about these policies as, you know, as affirmative action, but they're right now, the way that this practice plays out at colleges and universities is very different from how we might generally understand this practice. You know, in the past, these policies have involved set-aside programs where institutions set aside a number of spaces for students from underrepresented populations. They've done that in order to address the effects of past and ongoing racial discrimination. Or you have quotas where institutions have some kind of target percentage. And in these past cases, starting in the mid-1970s, the court deemed these practices unconstitutional. It said that if institutions were going to be able to use race in their admissions policies and practices, it could only be used as one factor among many for the purpose of promoting a racially diverse student body and the educational benefits that come along with that, which are very connected to that institutional mission. So based on these past decisions, institutions have moved to what's called this holistic admissions process, where they use race as one of a number of factors that also look at socioeconomic status as well. And they've done this in order to not necessarily address, they can no longer be able to use it to address past discrimination, but to attain these educational benefits that research has documented are there for students.
I know you've done studies of California, Washington, Florida, Michigan, Nebraska, Arizona, New Hampshire, and Oklahoma that ban the consideration of race in post-secondary admissions. What have you found at those schools as a result of not considering race? What's happened to diversity? What's happened to the atmosphere on campuses when it comes to racial acceptance, when it comes to achievement?
Well, my research has looked at the impact of these laws in these states that have banned race-conscious policies, and I've done that both by looking at what has been the impact on the representation of students of color in different graduate fields of study and the field of medicine, but also how are these policies influencing the efforts of campus-level administrators who are in charge of supporting students of color and in promoting racial diversity and improving the racial climate for students. The studies that I conducted that were looking at the representation of students of color, the findings from study was where I was looking at the impact in particular in graduate fields of study, I found that the representation of Latino, African American, Native American students declined as a consequence of these laws. And the greatest declines were in science-related fields of engineering, where just in that field alone, you saw an overall decline of about 26%, and as well as the natural sciences and in other fields like social sciences and the humanities. And these are the kinds of declines that can have very serious long-term consequences for our ability to compete effectively in a global market. It also has consequences for the students of color who remain at those institutions where you have less racial diversity. There was another study that I conducted with a fellow researcher where we were looking at the impact of these laws in medical schools as well. And there we found that these bans have led to declines of underrepresented students of color at public medical schools. These declines have been from about 18% to about 15%. So it means that, you know, before affirmative action bans, for every 100 students who matriculated in medical schools in states with bans, there were 18 students of color. But after these bans, for every 100 students who matriculate, there's only about 15. Mm. And that's an important difference. It really hurts the efforts in the field of medicine to become more racially and ethnically diverse, and that in turn has very negative consequences for ability to address health disparities in our society.
Mm-hmm. You also have written about the potential exacerbating of racial tensions that we're seeing around the country if the Supreme Court rules that race cannot be considered. Why do you see possibility of increase in racial tensions?
Well, this relates to another study that I conducted about the influence of these bans and the potential consequences that it might have for the ability of institutions, if race in admissions were further restricted, a negative decision could have consequences that the findings from my study suggest might then be present on these campuses. In a separate study, I was looking at the ways in which administrators at the University of Michigan in particular, Michigan is a state where you have a ban on these practices with Proposal 2, and we wanted to see what the influence of that law had been for administrators who are charged with supporting students of color, and what the findings show is that the policies can have had negative consequences on their work as well. So we may not think that admissions policies would then have this consequence on the work of individuals for after students enroll, but in fact, that's what the findings from this study show. We interviewed about 14 individuals at the University of Michigan, and this was about 5 years after Prop 2 had been in place, And when they talked about how the law influenced their efforts, they talked about how the law made it much more difficult for them to have conversations around race and racism, how it made their efforts around racial diversity less visible. And they talked about feeling much less empowered to be able to advocate for racial diversity. They were concerned that it contributed to students' perceptions that the institution was no longer committed to racial diversity. And so what these findings suggest is that when you limit the consideration of race at the outset, at the admission stage, it can essentially potentially undermine the support for students of color and what they need to succeed once they're on campus. That's because research consistently documents that efforts to support diversity on campus need to be visible, they need to be sustained at various levels of the institutions, individuals need to feel empowered to do their work that's necessary to support students of color. Mm.
So I'm wondering if those bans have been found their way, as a challenge has found its way to the Supreme Court. And the second part of the question would be, if the Supreme Court rules in favor of the University of Texas, Austin, will it have bearing on these bans in 8 states?
It will not. The way that our constitutional system is set up is that you have the federal, so you've got the court that's interpreting our U.S. Constitution, and it's saying that under the Constitution, the practice is constitutional, it's legal. However, the states still have the right to be able to pass laws that ban the practice. And that's what's happened in these 8 states. They've done it via ballot measures, as well as other in Florida, for example, it was an executive order by then Governor Jeb Bush. And most recently, we had a legislative act in New Hampshire.
Hmm. So do you have any sense at this moment, Liliana, which way the U.S. Supreme Court is going? And once again, are we finding ourselves where Justice Kennedy is going to perhaps have the deciding vote?
Yes, I believe that Justice Kennedy, as the first time around, is right now a very decisive vote. No one anticipated a 7-1 opinion the first time it came around. When you look at the composition of the court and the justice's position in past cases, so anything that we were to say about the way that the case is going to come out would be speculation. I would merely be guessing, but we can have some suggestions from what happened at oral argument. The court might be willing to reach another compromise, which is what happened the first time around. That compromise could be on the question of standing, for example. There were some questions about whether Abigail Fisher has, in fact, continues to have standing in this case. She has gone on to graduate from another institution. But then again, the court, those were questions that were still present the first time around, and the court still took the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we look at Justice Kennedy, in some analysis that I've done with respect to his position, he has this position that where he has acknowledged in past cases that race continues to matter in our society, but yet what he's expressed concern about is that the ways in which we go about addressing that through racial classifications. He's concerned that we not do it in a way that would further entrench racial differences. He talks about trying to balance these two important principles in our Constitution, the principle of liberty, where, it's kind of embodied in our ability to express ourselves free of any racial categories, but then the principle of equality, where we don't want opportunity to be denied on account of race. And one of his concerns is that, as expressed in these past opinions, is that when we look at race in these practices, it can be harmful because it means that we're placing somebody in a racial category which could be inconsistent with, our dignity as individuals. And so for that reason, and he's expressed a preference for looking at race more generally, in ways that are more generalized, like looking at geography. In the legal arena, these are called what would then be race-neutral approaches. One example might even be the percent plan. We can argue about that, whether in fact it is race neutral or not, given that it depends on highly racially segregated high schools. And part of the problem is that, yes, race does operate in at these more structural levels, right? It shapes a child's life chances, including their opportunity for quality of education. But it also operates at this very individual level where it can influence our thoughts, our behavior, in ways that are subconscious. These are implicit biases. They're attitudes that we might have toward particular social groups. They're psychological phenomena that are called stereotype threat. These are can be classically manifested when students are taking high-stakes test performance and they involve, you know, threatening the experience of conforming to a negative race-based stereotype that might be present in larger society. And because, you know, and then we carry stereotypes, whether we want to or not, or whether we're even aware of it. And because we rely on these racial categories when we make some social judgments, just removing the classifications themselves isn't going to make race go away. And because it shapes our attitudes and behavior subconsciously, when we don't pay attention to it, it can make it much more difficult for us to look at the ways in which it shapes those thoughts and behaviors and experiences and the actions of educators and administrators on campuses.
We're going to welcome phone calls for you. We're talking about what the Supreme Court, they've heard arguments on this. It's for the second time, actually, in a couple of years. The Supreme Court is reviewing the constitutionality of race-conscious admissions at the University of Texas, Austin. And there has been speculation that the court's review could change the way not only University of Texas, Austin, can legally consider race in their admissions policy. It could also change the way that many other colleges and universities consider race. How should race be considered? We're looking specifically at the case of Abigail Fisher. She was rejected by the University of Texas at Austin. She is white. She claims that she was not accepted to the school in 2008 on the basis of her race. The case was heard in the Supreme Court in 2012 and then sent back to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, where they ruled that Fisher failed to make her case. Fisher appealed to the Supreme Court, which she had every right to do again in 2015. The court could rule on this by the end of June. What do you think? How should race be considered? Should it not be a factor? What do you think of this particular case? We welcome your phone calls, and here's how you reach us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And please, in your response, put it in the context of 2016. Where we don't have to look past the University of Missouri and what happened with African-American students on that campus. Does it matter, this kind of decision, now more than ever? Does it exacerbate racial tension on campus if race is not considered as a factor? We would love to hear from you, and we will, in just a moment, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Liliana Garces. She is assistant professor in the higher education program and a research associate in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at the Pennsylvania State University. And let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. And our first caller is from Texas, Virgil calling from Texas. Hi, Virgil.
Hello.
Hi. Go right ahead.
Basically, I was liking to say I went to the University of Texas from 1970 and 1974, and as I understand it, understood at that time, the first black to ever come to University of Texas was in 1960, and they had never had a black come in at the University of Texas before that time. But also one of my roommates, I had a house off campus, and one of my roommates on that was a young black man, and he was an athlete. That was the only reason he ever got into the University of Texas, because he could provide a service for them.
Hello, Liana.
Yes, hi, Virgil. Thank you for your call. I think you raised an important point about the history that UT Austin is also contending with, and its past discriminatory practices, and now trying to address that in some ways by needing to create a more welcoming environment for students of color at that campus. And that is one thing that the UT Austin mentioned in its brief when this case was before the court the first time around, was about the importance of having policies like race-conscious admissions policies that can send a signal to students of color that they're welcome at that institution, and that helps promote a much more inclusive campus climate. It's not the only thing, but it's certainly an important signal.
Virgil, what do you think the answer is? What kind of policy should we have?
Well, I think the University of Texas is actually, the university itself, I'm very proud of them, and that they have I know quite a few of the regents, and they have been very open to try to make the university a diverse place of education. I mean, they have a tremendous amount of money. They have a tremendous program. They have multiple universities, and they've worked real hard to include everyone. I think the sad thing is that the Texas politicians are becoming more and more white. I mean, they just have become more and more conservative, more and more excluding. But the University of Texas and its regents have done a remarkable job in the political atmosphere that they're trying to work in.
And what do you think has been the outcome? How has it helped, particularly minority students?
Well, it allows, you know, with the situation you have, number one, the best students in Texas can go to the University of Texas. I mean, the top 10%. But then you can also look at women, minorities, the poor. It just adds more diversity. You know, it adds just more, you know, quality people that you know, education's more than just the books and what you. So much of my education were the people I met, people I got to know, and so many of them were, you know, sadly enough, very few of them in my time were minorities. Very few of them in my time were women.
Mm-hmm.
But the school was basically a male white society and male white women. Female white females. But you go there now, and it's becoming more and more diverse, and it's having, I think, more of a positive impact on the state itself. I mean, the graduates, their schools are graduating, especially, you know, the quality of the school is greatly improved.
Thank you. Thanks, Virgil, for the call. Liliana, further comment?
Well, Virgil is really also addressing and speaking to what a lot of the research documents in terms of the benefits of a racially diverse student body in promoting cross-racial understanding. It helps reduce racial prejudice. It improves critical thinking skills, academic achievement, and it prepares students for a more diverse workforce. And society, and it helps provide pathways for leadership within the state of Texas and the nation overall as well. And these are all benefits that have been widely documented by research that were endorsed in the Supreme Court's decision in 2003, which was the last time the case this issue was before the court. And the court's Fisher opinion the first time around also endorsed that. It left all those questions in place. And what's not necessarily, you know, that's, you have some briefs that were filed in support of Abigail Fisher's side, trying to ask the court to reverse that precedent, but that's not really what's directly before the court at this time. It's about the way in which we go about promoting those benefits and whether race can be considered at all.
Virgil, thanks for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We have a line open for you right now, Dave in Toma. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. You know, we've had this affirmative action around for quite some time. And in the big picture, I think we're not really gaining ground. We've been losing ground. And I just don't see where the positive is for continuing it. I think it's a benefit that was a fabulous benefit to give once upon a time. But in the last 40, 50 years since we've had affirmative action, I think that the use of it has been squandered. I don't think people have taken advantage of it. I've personally myself, when I was younger and trying to get into the workforce, been told I couldn't have a job because they didn't have their quotas of minorities. And I think we should be past that. I think if we got a student who's qualified, more qualified than somebody else to be in based on their scores, they shouldn't be discriminated against. And I'll listen to your response off the line.
All right, Dave, thanks for the call. Liliana.
Thanks, Dave, for offering your perspective. I think what you're raising is, in some ways, the idea that you know, these policies could be showing preference or they represent some, you know, discrimination against a particular group. But what, you know, in some ways when we look at classifications, that equates classifications with discrimination. I think the two things are different. And what the perspective of looking at these policies as racial preferences, really, I think it represents a more colorblind perspective on policymaking that leads us to not really look at the underlying inequities that are currently in place by looking at these practices as preferences. You know, we can try to look at them as trying to ensure equal protection for all citizens, but it's a framing that really diminishes the significance of long-standing racial inequities and other policies that are in place, like admissions preferences for children of alumni that generally privilege whites and disadvantage African Americans. And so that's a framing that I think we need to not ignore the broader context of accumulated disadvantage for students of color from past and ongoing discriminatory practices.
Liliana, he makes a point, and it's a valid one, that it did do 40 or 50 years ago when we first started affirmative action. A lot of people, minorities and women, broke into fields that had been off limits to them, and we noticed changes. I noticed changes right away in the media world. Why is it that it's taking so long in order to achieve true diversity? 50 years ago is a long time ago.
Well, yes, and I think in some ways this relates to the fact that it's not what the policy that we have now is not the policy we had back then. And that relates to the ways in which the court cases have redefined what affirmative action is and limited the practice that institutions can have. They've really changed the way in which the institutions can go about addressing past discrimination and opening avenues for populations that, you know, in places where they were prevented from being. And now it's more about a forward-looking diversity rationale that has a lot of benefits, but it also is limited in how it can address these questions of past discrimination.
We go to Charlie in Madison next. Hello, Charlie.
Hello.
Hi.
I've worked in higher education admissions for the last 15 years, and I sat on the board of an organization that's goal was to promote underrepresented minorities into higher education. And the biggest challenge that I saw was quite often our underrepresented minority students were not representative of a specific socioeconomic target. And so quite often we'd have students of the majority that were of lesser socioeconomic circumstances than the students of the minority that would then end up in our programs. And so it was a continual challenge. And I was wondering, Liliana, if you had a perspective on the fact that the rankings system that's out there for colleges and universities and plays such a huge part in endowments and funding and reputation and career placement for students post-graduation, those rankings take into account the diversity of a campus. And until they don't, how do you do it, an admissions policy that allows students in to hit the numbers that are required in order to maintain the rankings that then maintain the integrity of the institution as a whole?
Liliana, it's all yours.
Yes, Charlie, thank you for your question. I hope I'm understanding it correctly. So you're asking whether, can you repeat your, I'm sorry for asking you to repeat.
Sure, no, I was a little long-winded. I think my question is, the rankings that are out there are so influential when it comes to a student's ultimate success, right? It's endowment, it's alumni, it's career placement, and those rankings heavily weight the diversity of a campus. And so if you move to a race-blind admissions policy, how do you ensure that you have that diversity on that campus in order to then continue the legacy of the institution?
Well, yes, that speaks to if you prevent race from being able to be considered, I think it's going to make it that much more difficult for you to be able to ensure, for an institution to ensure that they have a racially diverse campus. Back to the findings of some of my studies, they chose that when we ban the consideration of race, it leads to declines in racial diversity, and that in turn affects the campus climate for other students. So what it really speaks to is for the need to continue to have these policies.
And thank you so much, Charlie, for your call. We have lines open if you'd like to join us. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org, Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Liliana, you've written that colleges and universities need all the tools that they can have at their disposal to improve race relations on their campuses. What are those tools?
Well, one of the tools is race-conscious admissions policies, where institutions can these are policies that allow the institutions to generate, to have diversity on their campus. Again, it's not just a question of numbers. I think it also is important the kind of practices that you have in place to be able to support students. So one important tool are race-conscious policies that allows the institution to generate the numbers, to signal to students of color that they're welcome at that institution. And then once students are on campus, to have the kinds of programs and practices in place that creates the positive racial climate that we know is important for them to experience, to be able to generate the benefits of diversity, to attend to any kinds of legacies, historical legacies of exclusion, to try to promote productive interactions within the classroom, a very important space for students to interact with one another, to be able to have the numbers there so that students are not experiencing racial isolation where they might be the only one. In those circumstances, you know, it can make someone's race much more salient and inhibit the kind of interactions that we want among students to be able to promote those benefits that the research has demonstrated is part of racial diversity. And to try to promote those cross-racial interactions, I think an important piece is to give administrators and faculty to have them feel empowered and knowledgeable in how to talk about race, how to encounter how to address circumstances that might come up in their classroom. You know, in my own classes, when I'm talking about this, when I teach courses on race and equity in education, I try to be very intentional in the environment that I need to create in that space so that students can have those interactions and those discussions. These are really, they can be very uncomfortable conversations to have to talk about race. It can be very emotionally laden. And so that takes some skill in practice, and for institutions to be able to do that for their faculty, I think is important.
More phone calls in just one moment. Our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We're talking about the future of affirmative action. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering, they've heard the arguments, they'll decide the case by the end of June, Fisher versus the University of Texas. In case you're just tuning us in, the case began in 2008 when Abigail Fisher, a white female, applied to the University of Texas, Austin. She was denied admission. She sued the university on the grounds that its race-conscious admissions policy violated the 14th Amendment. It went back to the Fifth Circuit Court, and now it's gone back to the U.S. Supreme Court. So this could be a fairly broad ruling that might apply to many other colleges and universities. Our guest this hour has done a lot of research in this area. She is Lillian Garces, an assistant professor of education at Pennsylvania State University. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Okay, back to phone calls. Steve is next in Richland Center. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, in all this discussion of diversity on college campuses, I guess I kind of feel like socioeconomic background is a pretty important factor, and that can really stimulate diversity on campus if that's taken into account. I guess I'm just wondering, as we try to increase racial diversity on a campus, is the socioeconomic diversity, is that also addressed? Is that also improved on campus?
Steve, thank you for that question. What UT Austin does is that the university looks at both race and socioeconomic status, and it really is a question of looking at both factors. The reason that we look at race more strictly is because it's something that triggers constitutional review. Socioeconomic status does not. It's not one of those categories in our Constitution that gets the courts involved, and so that becomes questions of race become more prevalent in the legal arena. But institutions, in fact, look at both factors, and it's important to have a full, truly diverse student body where we have both race and socioeconomic status diversity.
I wanted to ask you, I know you served as counsel of record here, a friend of the court brief that was filed in the Fisher case by 823 social scientists across the country. What did they look at?
Yes, so this is a brief, an amicus brief. As you said, it's a friend of the court brief. These are filed not by main parties in the case, but by individuals, organizations that have an interest in the outcome of the case. And this stems from the fact that I'm a recovering lawyer. I practiced law in the past, and it influences the questions that I ask. Mm-hmm. And so I'm able to act as a translator of sorts for the court so that the court can have, and for the social science community, so that we can present findings from the social science community to the legal audience, to the court, so that can inform its deliberations. And what the brief was filed in support of UT Austin, and it was presenting evidence where you had a consensus from the social science community demonstrating why race-conscious policies continue to be needed because these other alternatives have not been sufficient to be able to generate the truly diverse student body that UT Austin is trying to achieve. And some of the information that we presented in the brief relates to, whether the percent plan in Texas, in fact, has been able to generate that diversity, what the research and evidence shows with respect to socioeconomic status. And when you look at it instead of race, the research consistently demonstrates that they're simply just not good substitutes for one another. You have, there's some correlation, but they're not SES cannot replace race in terms of generating racial diversity. You have a lot of African-American, Latino college students who are neither poor or in first generation of their family to go on to college. And also they represent a much small fraction of all low-income youth and an even smaller fraction of high-achieving low-income youth. And so we presented evidence to show why it was that you needed both factors. And in fact, when you look at both, it consistently generates higher levels of racial and ethnic diversity at institutions.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. Jim, Wisconsin somewhere. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
It's Joe.
Oh, it's Joe. Hi, Joe.
A couple of points I'd like to make. First off, they seem to assume that diversity in and of itself is a good thing, whereas there are numerous studies, in particular, Robert Putnam's The Downside of Diversity, that show that the more diverse the neighborhood, more diverse the community, the less social trust there is. And not only that, but the social sciences, which he keeps bringing up, is hopelessly corrupt. It has a huge, it can't replicate its findings. So I'll put these studies that are put up in these peer-reviewed journals, but then when they try to replicate the studies like you're supposed to do in science, they can't do it because there's a tremendous leftist bias within the social sciences. And so the social sciences shouldn't really consider it a science because they don't follow scientific method. And the second thing I'd like to bring up is the fact that there are Chinese immigrants who come here that are penniless, don't speak English, and they end up living in the ghetto. Yet their children grow up and become highly successful. And these are people, children who are becoming discriminated against in college admissions. They have to score much higher scores. But yet they still do much better than even white kids whose parents were born in this country. So I don't think it's a matter of discrimination, and I don't think it's a matter of needing more diversity. I think the problem is when you create an artificially high standards for some groups, artificially low standards for other groups, you end up with what people don't trust the people who have artificially low standards for them.
All right, got it. Liliana.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for calling in and for your passion around these issues. You know, diversity, when we bring different groups of people together, it just by bringing them together is not going to help us generate what the research has shown have been the benefits of diversity. Institutions, in fact, need to do their part to create those conditions that help generate those that cross-racial interaction, the mutual respect and trust that that racially diverse community brings. I can't speak to the last part of what you said because I'm not sure where the evidence is there. But what institutions are trying to do by having these race-conscious policies is to be able to look at the full set of experiences and the identity of every student. We live in a society where race influences opportunities. It can shape our experiences and perspectives. This is the case for all students, but especially for students of color. It may not always be the case, but it's an inevitable reality for many. And to ask them to not be able to identify and relate to this one dimension of their multifaceted identity would be to deny them the ability to present their full selves to admissions officers.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We are out of time. Joe, thanks for the call. Liliana, thank you very much. We'll be following this with interest as the months go ahead. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Liliana Garces, she is assistant professor in the higher education program and a research associate in the Center for the Study of Higher Education at Penn State University. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour, to KP Whaley for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. Thanks for your calls. Stay with us. The food supplement industry, it's going to be a fascinating conversation, and that will be on the air following the news.